Hi folks, Barry here. Just before we listen to this episode of The Third Foot, our bonus episode, which is all about dancing this month. Now, we don't usually do an intro on the start of these, but as you may have heard us banging on about recently, we have a live show coming up, a live podcast recording. Oh my gosh, people in a room listening to us and watching us with their eyes, not just with your ears. 10th of October at 7:30 p.m. at the Backyard Comedy Club in Bethnal Green in London, and we have three amazing guests on the show as well. They've all been guests on the podcast in the past and they're coming back to join us. They are Beck Hill, Jay Foreman and Ria Lena, absolute comedy titans, and we are so pleased that they'll be joining us for our World's Worst Literary Salon. We're going to be reading extracts from terrible novels and plays and poetry and have some music, and there will be games and our usual stupid, silly, useless trivia to entertain you over the course of an hour to an hour and a bit. Tickets are just £7 or £5 if you're a Patreon donor. Our Patreon donors have got in there with a little cheeky discount. So if you want to support the show and get a discount to the live show, then you can go to patreon.com/worstfootforward and support us on there. Now, if you've been thinking about coming along to the live show and you're umming and eyeing, how's about a little dangly carrot to coax you along? We have to thank our Patreon donors, David and Tyler Harrington, longtime supporters of the show, past judges on the show on our World's Worst Coffee episode. They're based over in America. They're not coming to the show themselves, but they wanted to support the podcast and they very generously have paid for 6 tickets to the show. And they just messaged us and said, we're buying 6 tickets. Please dispense them as you see fit. So if you would like to claim one of the 6 free tickets to our live show on the 10th of October, as I said, 7:30 p.m, Backyard Comedy Club in Bethnal Green in London, then just drop an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. We are deciding to limit it to one person claiming up to 2 tickets. So if it's you and a plus one, specify that you're claiming 2 tickets or 1 ticket. And just to make you work for them, include maybe a favourite fact from the podcast or let us know what your favourite episode is. So up to 6 individuals or 3 people with a plus one, worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. And thank you again, David and Tyler. We are so, so grateful for your support for the show. And what a lovely gesture. What a nice group of listeners this podcast has, eh? So yeah, if you're one of the people who claims those tickets, you've very much got David and Tyler to thank for that. As I said, it's first come, first served. So once they're gone, they're gone. We'll put a tweet out on @worstfoot and hopefully see you there. A little bit of a teaser. We may have another live show coming up in the spring. More on that in a few episodes' time, I think. We've got to sell as many tickets to this one, first of all. Again, go to the link in the description of the podcast. Buy your tickets. Come see us. Live show. Beck Hill. Jay Foreman. Ria Lena. Bethnal Green. 10th of October. 7:30 p.m. Ben and I will be there. You'll be there. You'll be there, right? You'll be there. Meanwhile, enjoy this episode. Just Ben and me chatting a little bit deeper about the wonderful world of dance. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, The Third Foot, our bonus monthly episode where we dive a little bit deeper, look back into a subject that we've covered before in the podcast, get nitty and gritty with it. And this month, Ben, I've been inspired by some inspiring viewing on British TV, because my favourite time of year has come around again. Strictly Come Dancing, aka Dancing with the Stars to everyone else around the world, is back on our televisions. And not only does it feature its first deaf contestant in the actress Rose Ailing Ellis, but we also have the first all-male pairing with TV chef John Waite dancing with Johannes Radeby, which is so beautiful.
It was. They absolutely bossed it as well.
Yeah, it was an amazing, amazing tango they performed. And in watching that, it made me think, well, you know what? One of the other contestants on the show this year is actor and comedian Robert Webb. And when we did World's Worst Dance a long, long time ago with Abigail Burdus, Robert's partner, we talked about the World's Worst Dance. So I thought it seemed only right that we'd look at dancing. And I have done a little bit of a dive into the 10 dances that are part of the World 10 Dance Championship. These are sort of the 5 ballroom and 5 Latin dances that are traditionally competed in competitive
dance competitions.
The World Ted Danson.
The World Ted Danson competition. Yeah. So there are 10 dances, 5 international ballroom dances, the waltz, foxtrot, quickstep, tango, and Viennese waltz, and the 5 international Latin dances, rumba, samba, paso doble, cha-cha-cha, and dive. And jive.
You have just activated a Manchurian candidate somewhere in a dance studio.
And dive. And people who watch Strictly and other variations of the show will know that they also dance things like the Charleston and the American Smooth and the Salsa and the Argentine Tango and things on the show. But I thought I'd do a quick little rundown, a few facts on each of the 10 dances. So let's go to the oldest one first, the Viennese Waltz. First ballroom dance performed in closed position. And I think we've mentioned on the show before, the waltz was considered very sexy when it sort of first debuted. Because most dances up to that point were sort of more performative. They were danced to the onlooker. They were communal sequence dances and they'd take part in a pattern.
Danced at a distance, like in Shakespeare in Love, where they press palms together. But no, you know, the waltz, you are clasping your partner's body. Admittedly, any South American worth their salt is looking at that and going, that is tepid foreplay, my European friend.
Yeah, and because of in the waltz, obviously people are looking inwards rather than outwards to an audience. So dancing before that was much more performed and for the onlooker, whereas this has brought people together. So it's considered very naughty and sexy. In fact, Lord Byron, not a man averse to naughtiness and sexiness, wrote a poem, The Waltz, and he has a letter which accompanies it where he decries the antisocial nature of the dance. He says the couple are like two cockchafers spitted on the same bodkin. Cockchafers are doodle bugs, before you ask.
No, I completely understand. Just Byron attempting to de-sex a dance there and then dropping the wrong bird. I'm going to say that I thought you were going to say Lord Byron first performed the waltz with his pet bear.
Yeah. So he had a dancing bear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Waltz comes from the German word waltzen, by the way, which means to turn. And that's the Viennese waltz is the original dance. The waltz that the competition dance, the more modern waltz that people dance, is called the slow waltz. The Viennese waltz tends to be danced at a much faster pace. And I think the slow waltz was popularized in the early 1800s by people like Strauss, who were helping to give the waltz a little bit more of a more respectable air. You know, right. Don't be dancing too frantically and all of that stuff.
So it's basically like a public school pub punk band.
Yes,
A Viennese waltz you just do where you've got clotted cream in your trousers and chocolate piping down the arms of your suit.
Yeah. And I read a bit more about the waltz and particularly Johann Strauss's most famous waltz, the Blue Danube.
Mm-hmm.
And the original performance of it was only sort of lukewarmly received. In 1866, it was, as I say, composed by Johann Strauss II, premiered at a concert in the Wiener Mannergesangverein. He was so unhappy with it, he said, "The devil take the waltz, my only regret is for the coda. I wish that had been a success." And we all remember the coda of Anders Schoenenblau and Danau. Yeah, me too. I think it was a, sort of a sung piece initially. But then he adapted it into an orchestral version for the World's Fair in 1867. And that was a huge success straight away in Paris. It took Paris by storm. It's the one that everyone knows today. Strauss's stepdaughter, Alice, once met the composer Brahms. And she asked him to sign. She had a fan. They had these things called autograph fans where they would get people to sign their fan. And so Alice Strauss asked Brahms to sign her autograph fan. And he wrote down the opening bars of the Blue Danube on it. And then said, "Unfortunately, not by Johannes Brahms." was what he wrote on it. So that's the Viennese waltz and the waltz, two in one. And then the foxtrot. That's the sort of the other, you know, very classy dance that people always want to do when they're on shows like Strictly.
I would like to see someone perform the foxtrot where the two dancers were being pursued by a man on horseback in a red jacket with a little bugle.
Well, there is some uncertainty about why the dance is called the foxtrot. One suggestion is that the fox can walk naturally with its feet under its body in a straight line. The foxtrot, as all of these ballroom dances are, is a progressive dance where you progress across the floor with your partner following a path.
Yeah, it's a very sort of tippy-toe dance, isn't it, the foxtrot?
Yeah, it's usually danced a big band. It's in 4-4 rather than in 3-4. It looks a bit similar to the waltz, but yeah, it usually has that sort of big band North American feel and very flowing movements. The other suggestion is it came from a vaudevillian actor, Harry Fox, So the dance premiered in 1914, and there was this famous husband and wife duo called Vernon and Irene Castle, who danced on Broadway and were famous silent movie stars. And they helped to refine the dance. It was originally, you know, originated among African-American dancers and so on. In fact, W.C. Handy, the father of the blues, claimed that his composition, The Memphis Blues, which is a ragtime track, inspired the Castles to dance the foxtrot. Basically, between their big numbers, they would sometimes dance to a slowed down version of the Memphis Blues, and that dance became the foxtrot.
Nice. So,
but it obviously isn't called the Handy Trot. There's one theory which sounds vile.
It really does. I mean, I'm also wondering about what other dancers named after woodland creatures would look like. Oh, look what they're doing. They're dancing the badger.
Yeah. Well, Fox, this guy, Harry Fox, he apparently, Vernon and Irene Castle were dancing this dance, which I think probably would have been called the bunny hug, the version of it they were doing at the time. And then this guy, Harry Fox, is listed in some, you know, dance performance almanac. The performance is called Foxtrot Number 2, as danced by Mr. Fox, but it's two words at the time, so they're describing it as a trot performed by Fox. But foxtrots were the most popular communal dance for people to do up until, you know, the advent of rock and roll dance halls and things like that. So Decca Records in the USA would initially label its rock and roll releases as foxtrots, including Bill Haley and the Comets' Rock Around the Clock was released labeled as a foxtrot.
That's brilliant. I love that. I mean, it's an irresistible tune to dance to.
Yeah, I really want someone Strictly to dance a proper foxtrot to that now.
Yeah.
Next up, I looked at the Quick Step. Very light-hearted, quite bouncy, very powerfully flowing, lots of syncopation in it as well.
And frankly, the Quick Step should be done whilst dressed as one of those lizards who scamper along the Sahara Desert.
Yes. It's got all those amazing like kicks and flicks in between your partner's legs and sort of pendulum movements and all. I love the Quick Step. If I was doing Strictly, that's the number one dance I would want to do. And it, again, came out of first dance by Black Americans, African Americans. It sort of seems to sort of come from a slow foxtrot combined with elements of the Charleston, and origination in the 1920s in New York City. But I sort of, all of those, the waltz and the foxtrot and the tango, which I'll mention in a second, they all have this ballroom pose, which has these long arm extensions. And one of the suggestions about why we do that is that people just got really sweaty under their arms. So it was to save your partner. You would sort of try and dance with a little bit more distance where, you know, the woman leans back. So you sort of connected at the chest, and you have this sort of vase shape, V shape, where the woman leans back away from the partner and the arms are outstretched. And it's probably because certainly the upper classes and indeed the lower classes didn't bathe as regularly. So it was saving the assault on the nostrils. And the other reason is often in ballroom hold, you have the partner by being on one side of your partner. You're not directly body to body with them. You're sort of offset slightly. Do you know why we do that?
No, go on.
It's suggested that in the olden days, it's because men would still dance with swords on their hips.
Do you know what? That's one of those go-to answers for so many questions. Why? Yeah. Because men needed to be armed.
Yeah. So when they were in closed hold, obviously, they didn't want to stab their female partner in the leg.
I'd love that on Strictly. Well, I would have given you a 10, but I'm afraid Marjorie has bled out on the dance floor, so it's an 8 from me.
Yeah. And finally, the last ballroom dance is the tango. And it's the Argentine tango is also danced on Strictly quite a lot as well. And the tango all
rather
come
than from the Geordie tango, which is where a fat orange man comes up to you, slaps you in the face and then runs away.
There are tangos from lots of other countries, apparently. There's even Finnish tango. Apparently, tango music was hugely popular in Finland in the early part of the 20th century. No one quite knows why. So there is a style of tango dance which has been developed in Finland as well.
Finland has got a hugely well-respected jazz festival, so it's not too far from those.
Yeah, the tango, certainly the Argentine-influenced tango, originated in the 19th century in the suburbs of Buenos Aires and Montevideo. It's danced in 2-4 or 4-4 time. It's a very male-gazy dance, shall we say. It's very much about the man seducing and taming his woman in some ways. But there are some people who believe that certainly the tango was born in the brothels of Buenos Aires, but there's another suggestion that it was created by men because of the shortage of women in the immigrant population in Buenos Aires. I'm quoting from Christine Denniston's Clichés About Tango. There were only really two practical ways for a man to get close to a woman under these circumstances. One was to visit a prostitute and the other was to dance. The men practicing together, looking for the best ways to please a woman when they danced with her, preparing for that rare moment when they actually did have a woman in their arms, were the people who created the tango as a dance. And same-sex tangos, and it was the tango that John Waite danced on Saturday night. There are postcards of women dancing the tango together in France in the early part of the 20th century as well. And there's a brilliant movement called the Queer Tango Movement, which has sort of looked back at these early origins of the tango and gender non-conforming roles within dance. And so in Germany, in Hamburg in 2001, the Queer Tango Movement was formed. There was the first gay lesbian milonga was organized, apparently. And they had the first International Queer Tango Argentina Festival as well. And they have these festivals still in Hamburg and all over the world as well. They've them in Argentina and Denmark and Sweden and the USA.
That's tremendous.
Latin dances now. And I read about the rumba.
Which obviously you dance as a declension, you rumba, you rumbus, which is actually a square dance, the rumbus.
Yeah.
Rumbatum, rumbatus.
The rumba is the slowest of the international Latin dances, and it's a very sensual dance. In fact, it originated in Cuba. It's a bit like the Argentine tango explanation. Basically, men would dance the rumba as a way to entice romantic partners. So most of the Latin dances aren't danced in a hold and they're not progressive where you're moving across the floor together. You can be much more separate and playing off one another in that way. And so you can see from the rumba how it's very like wiggly, figure of eight hips and all of that stuff. It's very come to bed with me. And there was a film called Rumba released in America in 1935, which helped bring it to the attention of the wider public. But there's also a thing called the Congolese rumba or rumba lingala. Which is a genre of dance music in the Congo Basin. It originated there in the 1940s. When radio stations were growing up in the early part of the 20th century in Africa, Cuban music, the Cuban son style music, was really popular in the 1930s and 1940s. And so it really just took off across Africa in the 1960s and 70s. And it's known as Lingala in Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania, and in Zambia and Zimbabwe and the Congo. It's still referred to as a rumba. And in 2016, the UN recognized the Cuban rumba as a UNESCO heritage artifact, an item of important national heritage.
Yeah, you dance around a blue plaque.
Yeah, exactly. So this year, in 2021, the Congolese Minister of Culture launched a campaign to have the Congolese rumba recognized in the same way. So they're hoping to have their own recognition of the rumba. And much like the rumba is a sort of a national dance there, the samba is very much the national dance of Brazil. And samba is a whole thing. It's not just the ballroom danced samba is a whole separate thing to samba in Brazil and samba culture and so on in many ways, even though it originated from it. In fact, one of the things I read suggested is basically the most disconnected of the dances from its origins in many ways. Samba in Brazil is, you know, it's this big street party dance. It's often danced to much quicker music than the ballroom samba is, and it's usually danced solo. It's sort of out and performative, whereas obviously in the ballroom you've got a partner, and it's got this amazing bouncing action and very specific hip action and so on. But samba is also recognized by UNESCO as an intangible cultural heritage of humanity.
You didn't say the intangible bit the first time. I mean, you're right, it's intangible because you can't put a dance in a museum, but I don't know. I'd like some of the brain farts that I have at 3 a.m. to be
tangible cultural heritage.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah, well, I think, didn't we talk about musical notation and trying to write down dancing?
We chatted about that with Sakisa, didn't we?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think samba wouldn't look quite the same on the page as it does on the stage. If you're trying to, like, make it tangible or something, you can treasure or have in a museum in that way. You just have to have two people dancing it continuously in the museum from dawn till dusk. the Brazilian composer Ney Lopez described samba as the most impressive phenomenon of the 20th century. In 100 years, it went from being a persecuted culture to the symbol of a nation. Basically, the samba came out of the favelas and the black and former slave slums, certainly in Rio de Janeiro, and poverty and exclusion from society and all of those things helped create these massive slums in places like Rio de Janeiro, which had been an epicenter of trading and slavery in Brazil. And when slavery was abolished and you had all of these people released with no jobs and no resources, they bonded together. And samba was sort of grown out of all the traditional African music and Brazilian indigenous music as Brazilian, rural Brazilians moved to the city and so on as well. They all mixed together into this area called Pequena Africa, or Little Africa. And then in the 40s and 50s, there was this huge public push against the favelas, and they had very negative attitudes, and they were trying to, you know, clear these slums and eradicate them, and they suppressed loads of protest songs that were in samba by the Brazilian authorities. So just over half a century ago, they were trying to actively stop samba music because it represented
you know that it's a good form of music or dance if authorities are trying to ban it.
Yeah, exactly. And now here we are 60, 70 years after that, and it is the national dance and treasured in Brazil, obviously. The Paso Doble. I love the Paso Doble. It's a very sort of Spanish military march sort of sounding one.
The Spanish military dance. So it's basically Franco's dance.
Well,
the fascist two-step.
Well, you may
as well have people goose-stepping on Strictly.
Well, Paso Doble is a Spanish military march, but the Paso Doble, the ballroom dance, was actually originated in southern France and then went to Spain and then came back to France again. It's sort of in the 18th century, the Paso Doble music was played during the matador's entrance into a bullring, and then that made its way back into France, and it was interpreted into a dance by the Parisian upper classes. It wasn't until the
19th... bunch of toffs pretending to be animal abusers. Lovely.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's in the 1920s that they sort of choreographed this bullfighting into a dance, a performative dance. And there's the really famous Paso Doble music is the España Cani, which, I mean, people Google it and you'll know. It's the bit, it's the one with the... It's got the trumpet bit at the start and then the...
Yes,
it's,
of course.
Think of the music you think of when you think of bullfighting. It's that, basically.
Yeah. I thought España Cani was a TripAdvisor review about summer holidays from a Geordie in Spain.
Yeah, it sounds very much like it. No, it is a composition by Pascual Marquina, which was written in the 20s. And this is the music that people who watch Strictly Come Dancing will also know as the music that BBC News correspondent John Sargent danced, in inverted commas, to on the sixth series of Strictly.
He did the dance equivalent of speak singing.
Yeah, he very much did. John Sargent was previously sort of the hangdog face of serious BBC, in very like well-respected news and political reporter and so on. And then he appeared on Strictly, and I think this helped break it into the nation's consciousness in a way on the sixth series, where he dragged his partner, Christina Rianoff, literally across the floor like he's pulling a wheelie suitcase. And then he was so poor, and he was trying very hard to be good at the dancing. He was very earnest with it, and he really wasn't very good, but he stayed in the competition for ages because people wouldn't vote him out, to the point that he eventually actually pulled out because he thought it wouldn't be fair on the others who he said were much better than him. But that helped sort of embed the program in the UK. The thing I love most about the Paso Doble from reading about it is that because of its heavily choreographed tradition, ballroom Paso Doble is danced mostly competitively, almost never socially. It's too difficult to achieve widespread popularity. It takes up a lot of space, limiting it to special occasions.
It's essentially the bouncy castle of dancers.
Yes. The cha-cha-cha, or the cha-cha, a dance in 4-4, again, Cuban
origin.
Or
the cha, if you just want to be quick.
If you want to be really quick about it. Do you know what's called cha-cha-cha? You can probably have a guess at it.
Is it connected to tea?
If I tell you that the dance is sort of dance with, you know, the feet shuffling quite close together, it's sort of an onomatopoeia thing. It's lots of pressing against the floor. And it's sort of the cha-cha-cha of the feet against the floor is what creates the name of it. The largest ever cha-cha-cha was danced in 2016 in the Philippines by 14,725 participants. The Kidapawan city government roped in pupils from 10 public elementary schools, 3 high schools, 3 colleges, and local government employees and officials.
Oh, that's pretty difficult to dance when you're roped in.
Yeah. I know you so well, Ben. I know you're also curious to know if it's related to the cha-cha slide.
Of course I want to know that.
The cha-cha slide is a song by DJ Casper. He wrote it as a step aerobic routine for his nephew, who was a personal trainer at the time. And it's more inspired by Chicago stepping movement, which is a Chicago-based dance movement.
I prefer dancers that are influenced by Chicago deep pan pizza.
Yeah. but he wrote it. It was released as a single in 2000 and spent 5 weeks in the Billboard Hot 100 in America. But then it just continued to be a chart hit all over the place. It was number one in the UK in 2004, like 4 years after it was first released. It was a real slow burner. But the largest ever cha-cha slide, for those who are curious, was achieved by 3,231 participants at an event organised by Girl Guiding Northwest England on Blackpool Pleasure Beach in 2011. As far away from the Chicago stepping scene, I think, as you could get. And my favourite thing about it is the attempt was held in a closed tunnel with one controlled entrance so they could count the people going into it. But elsewhere in the park, 5,000 additional girl guides stopped what they were doing and joined in because the music was being played over the loudspeakers. But because they weren't in this pen, they weren't counted.
That's how I like my girl guide, penned into an enclosed tunnel. Imagine if you're just strolling around the pleasure beach for weekends and you take the wrong turning and suddenly you encounter 5,000 girl guides.
Yeah.
You're like, are you preparing for a revolution?
Now we march on the brownies.
Exactly.
And finally, the jive. Jive originated again in the United States from the African-American community in the 1930s. And it spread really, it became really popular in Europe very quickly because you had American soldiers bringing over, you know, Lindy Hop and Jitterbug and things like that to Europe in the 1940s when they came over to belatedly join in the war. And Azari brought some dancing with them. And in the USA, they tended to call it swing, but they use jive in the United Kingdom more so. And it's very fast, 176 beats per minute usually. It's got that very, certainly the modern jive has a very sort of high knees and very happy and boppy and all of that. In the 1920s, dance halls tried to ban the jive because you still had these progressive dances like the foxtrot where people were in hold progressing around the floor. And the dance hall owners didn't like that people dancing the jive were disturbing the quiet patrons who were gently foxtrotting their way around. Because they would have like designated routes they were following and then the jive is just kicking and flicking their way through them all. But I love jive particularly because the name of the dance comes from the African-American vernacular, jive talk, popularized by Cab Calloway in the 1930s. I didn't know this. Cab Calloway published a dictionary. In fact, he published three books. He published in 1938 Cab Calloway's Cat O'Log, a Hepster's Dictionary, which became the official jive language reference book of the New York Public Library. And he followed it up in 1939 with Professor Cab Calloway's Swing Formation Bureau, which told people how... It was like, that's like a sort of a book on usage and so on. Yeah. And he released several editions and in 1944 finished with the new Cab Calloway's Hepster's Dictionary, Language of Jive. Lem Sisse said that Cab Calloway was taking ownership of language for a people who just a few generations before had their own language taken away.
Good Lord, I'm so disappointed we didn't get a chance to talk about that on our worst dictionary episode.
Yes,
it's one of the best.
That's brilliant.
Cab Calloway is an absolute hero of mine. I adore him. I cannot think of many people on earth who make music as happy as he does.
Yeah, absolutely. I just had a quick look at some jive words from Cab Calloway to finish off. Hoochie Coocher. You might remember that Minnie the Moocher was a red hot Hoochie Coocher in the lyrics of the Cab Calloway song. Hoochie Coocher is a hot babe who dances lying down.
Mm-hmm.
So Hoochie Coochie is a bit of slap and tickle. Jelly Roll.
Well, so there was the famous pianist called, and indeed band leader called Jelly Roll Morton.
Yeah, correct.
It's either to do with piano playing or because you're a bit of a tabalard.
No, it's female genitalia or the act of coitus.
Oh, I mean, a lot of the time, it's like there's. I got introduced to a Louis Armstrong song, which again is one of the giddiest songs on earth, called Cheesecake, where it is the chorus is cheesecake, gobble, gobble, cheesecake, gobble, gobble, cheesecake, cheesecake. And let me tell you, Louis Armstrong is not actually talking about gobbling cheesecake.
Muggles, not a term invented by J.K. Rowling. Muggles are spliffs, marijuana cigarettes.
Oh.
Yeah.
I've never smoked a muggle in my life.
Yeah. Harry Potter talking a lot about muggles. Who knew? Who knew what he was getting up to in the Gryffindor
common
room?
Yeah, well, no wonder he thought he was a wizard.
Yeah. And finally, I really like this one. This is one that we use. You use this quite a lot. Chops.
Yeah, well, chops is your cheeks for blowing the trumpet, isn't it?
Yes, but that's why we say, like, your chops. You've got ability with something. He's got mm-hmm. chops with something, because it originates from like the way the mouth and the lips of really accomplished musicians like Dizzy Gillespie or Louis Armstrong would change yeah. when they were playing their instrument. And so, you know, he's got musical chops. Originated literally from that, and but it's a jive term that I think we use sort of fairly commonly.
I love that. That's yeah, great.
Really great. So there you go. Thank you, Strictly Come Dancing, for bringing us joy as the winter draws in, and thank you to Ben for indulging my passion for a show he really only passingly watches.
Listen, I'm sure I'll find a particular niche interest of mine to subject you to next month.
Yeah, coming next month is Ben's deep dive into the language of J.K. Rowling now he's heard about muggles.
Really don't want to have a deep dive into her language. Thank you very much. I'm terrified about what I'll find.
Yeah. Thank you for listening, guys, and see you next month. Bye.
Bye-bye.